the barbs sinking deep into her leather guard, and also catching a bit of unprotected skin. To her credit, she didn't cry out, only gritted her teeth and ripped the whip away, blood dripping from the barbs as she tossed it to the dust. "Clever," she growled. Raven casually yanked out her third whip, hoping she wouldn't need the fourth. Fire circled toward the left, slowly shifting her flaming sword from side to side.
"Prepare!"
the Shiva yelled again. One of the heavy iron gates groaned as it was cranked open. For a split second, nothing happened, both sisters training one eye on each other and the other on the deep shadows inside the wall. With 100 roars, a herd of Guanic poured from the opening, spreading across the arena as they fled some hidden enemy. Raven lost sight of fire as the huge reptiles swerved around them, brushing past on all sides. One collided with her shoulder, knocking her over and then barely missing her with its flat, clawed feet. She fought back to a standing position just in time to see that another beast was bearing down on her. This one wouldn't miss. There was only one option. She jumped, reaching out with both arms as the animal slammed into her. It squealed as the whip barbs sunk into its neck. Raven clutched with her opposite hand on the other side, digging her own nails into its flesh. The frightened Guanic snapped at her, but couldn't quite reach, even with its long neck. Kicking out, she clambered around its neck and straddled it. She was now above the fray, which gave her the chance to look for fire. Her eyes darted back and forth, strafing the stampede, which was beginning to thin out, but there was no sign of her sister. She spotted a cluster of fallen Guanic, which were in obvious pain, grunting and snapping their jaws at the air. Smoke curled from the midst of them, and the air held the distinct smell of burning flesh. A sword burst from the mound of reptiles, flames dancing along its tip. It was soon followed by a hand, and then an arm, and then the whole of fire, who was covered in green Guanic blood and bits of charred flesh and scales. If the crowd was loud before, they reached a crescendo now. Calypsians, who, of course, made annual trips to the fighting pits of Zoon to watch the sport of death, thrived on violence and battle as much as their Phoenician enemies to the west. Fire leapt from the top of the pile of dead Guanic, landing in a crouch in front of Raven and the beast she was now riding. The smell alone was enough to make Raven ill, but she maintained a straight face. "You always have to make an entrance," she said. "They got in my way." Fire shot back. What a waste of Guanic, Raven thought. That's when the real challenge came, the thing the reptiles had been running from. Long, black, hairy legs scurried from the gate. The Arak was so large it was forced to duck its head before emerging into the sunlight. All 12 of its eyes squinted for a few seconds, adjusting to the change. Gods, why does it have to be an Arak? Raven thought. She hated all spiders, both the small ones and the big ones. This was most definitely a big one, its bulbous head towering over them, staring down with all its dark, beady eyes. Its 8 legs were the width and height of trees, ending in blade-like feet that could skewer a Guanic from head to tail. And that's just what the Arak did, leaping forward and thrusting downwards, slashing through 2 reptiles at once, the stragglers squealing once, twice, and then releasing their last breaths. Victorious, the Arak unleashed a cry of its own, high-pitched and awful, its black maw opening wide to reveal a single row of knives. Another hole flashed open, and white, silky material dropped over the spider's victims. It used its legs to tie the material around them, creating cocoons of preserved flesh. "Dinner for later," Raven thought. "Hopefully I'm not the dessert." "It's too big for either one of us," Fire said. "We'll have to take it together." Raven knew she was right. "Don't tell me you're scared of a little spider," she said, dismounting from her Guanic. The animal would give her no advantage in this particular fight, not now that the Arak had showed up. The Guanic didn't need further urging, fleeing to the opposite end of the arena. "You're the only one who fears them," Fire retorted. Raven still remembered the time she woke up to hundreds of 8-legged creatures crawling all over her. Fire had collected them over the course of many days in order to play the prank on her older sister. Raven had had trouble sleeping for months afterwards, sometimes waking up screaming and brushing invisible spiders off her body. Not any more, Raven said, though that was a lie. On three?
One,
Fire said. The Arrak turned toward them, extracting its legs from the cocooned Guanic.
Two,
Raven said. The Arrak screamed, and Raven couldn't stop the shiver from rolling through her.
Three,
Fire cried. As one, they charged the spider, which charged them in turn. Fire swung her sword high and hard, slashing through one of the legs before it could impale her. The hairy appendage tumbled and rolled, and Raven leapt over it while simultaneously snapping her whip. The barbed end travelled straight into one of the Arrak's eyes, which exploded outwards with blue goo, like a popped membrane filled with paint. At that point, the Arrak went mad. It leapt and slammed its legs down again and again. It snapped its deadly round mouth at anything that moved. Raven hung on to her whip, getting yanked around, rolling across the dust. She pulled back hard, trying to dislodge the barbs, but they had sunk deep into the soft ocular cavity, holding fast. Fire fared slightly better, managing to dismember another two legs before getting knocked over by yet another of the spider's legs. It tried to step on her, but she rolled just out of range, the edge of her leather tunic getting skewered in the process. She tried to squirm away, but the Arrak had her pinned to the ground. Somewhere along the way she'd lost her grip on her sword, which was no longer sheathed in fire, and it was now just out of reach. Raven couldn't have helped her even if she wanted to, because she was in her own kind of trouble. The beast had managed to get the whip wrapped around one of its legs, and it was using it like it used one of its webs, spinning the cord in circles, pulling Raven closer and closer. Finally, she was forced to relinquish the weapon and dive away. She only had one whip left, which she extracted from her belt. With only five legs, one of which couldn't move because it was pinning Fire to the ground, the Arrak seemed off balance. Dark blue blood continued to gush from its devastated eye, running down several of its other eyes and dripping into its maw. Raven knew the only way to finish it off was to pierce its brain. Her skin felt itchy at the thought of getting anywhere near its bulbous head, but she gritted her teeth and ignored her fear, leaping and snapping her whip as high as she could, releasing a war cry that was one part anger, one part desperation. The barbs flew over the Arrak's eyes and landed on the crown of its head, piercing its thick, hairy skin. It jerked back in surprise, ripping Fire off the ground and sending Raven flying as she clutched the handle of her whip. As she soared through the air, she was dimly aware of her sister sliding off the spider's bladed foot and diving to grab her sword, which immediately burst into flame. Raven, however, quickly lost sight of her sister as she landed on the Arrak's head. The creature bucked and writhed and tried to dislodge her, but she held on tight with one hand while using her other to grab a short sword she had strapped to the side of her leg. She raised it high, preparing to jam it as hard as she could into the Arrak's brain. Heat washed over her, pouring in from all sides, angry red, orange, and yellow teeth, biting, snapping, singeing her hair and burning through her leather armor.
Ah!
She cried out, releasing both her knife and whip, and launching herself from the Arrak's head. To the Calypsians in attendance, she must have looked like a flaming bird, soaring for a few quick moments before landing with a bone-jarring thump in the dirt. She was still on fire. So she rolled rapidly, patting at her hair with her palms.
Ah!
She groaned, her cheek pressed to the dust, her eyelids fluttering. She blinked slowly, watching the Arrak writhe and squeal as it burned to death. Her sister came into focus, smoking, walking toward her, standing over her. Her entire body was wreathed in flames.
Show off,
Raven mumbled.
Do you submit, sister?
Although she knew her sister loved her, she also knew that she would do whatever was necessary to win the Empire, which left Raven with two options, submit or die, and she wasn't ready to die.
Yes,
she whispered. Fire raised her hands in victory, and the crowd roared. Later that same day, a war council was convened. Though the Shiva was master of order in Calypso only, he attended at Fire's request for his advice and counsel. Several leaders of the Guanero were also invited, as well as three Dragon Masters, and, of course, Raven and Whisper. Fire sat on the Dragon Throne, which could reasonably be nicknamed the Fire Throne now, considering it was crackling with unnatural flames. Raven took a step back, the heat too much for her already burned skin. Though her leather armor had mostly protected her, in several places, her left thigh, her abdomen, between her shoulder blades, the fire had eaten through and scorched her. Now, despite the cooling balm she'd rubbed on her skin, it felt like shards of glass were being shoved into her flesh. Her palms were badly burned too, wrapped in thick cloth to protect them from further injury. And, of course, her hair was gone. Though the flames had left a few of her lustrous dark locks, she'd chosen to have them shaved off so she could start fresh. Whisper had cried. Fire had laughed. Raven had done nothing but grit her teeth as she was doing now. It was partly due to the pain, and partly because she'd let her younger sister claim the Empire for herself. "What are our options against Fanes?" Fire asked the gathered council. Raven spoke up first. "Be patient. Allow the dragon brood to mature and train. Then, when we are at our strongest, we will attack." One of the dragon masters, a woman everyone referred to simply as Ryder, said, "The dragons require a year, at least." Raven shot her an appreciative smile. She'd known Ryder for years and considered her a key ally. "Any other options?" Fire said, not even looking at her. "More worthy options." Raven clenched her jaw. She didn't expect her sister to listen to her, but she had hoped she would at least discuss her ideas. The Guanero commander, a career warrior named Goggin, said, "We attack the Phoenicians now, when they don't expect it. With the Empress's unexpected passing..." A lump lodged itself in Raven's throat. "Vinhosa will believe he has time to grow his slave army. If we hit their capital city now, they won't be ready." Raven shook her head, which was beginning to ache, either from this conversation or from her injuries. "A quick attack is impossible. We would have to build ships, gather supplies, and the dragons..." "Forget about the dragons, sister," Fire said. "The dragons will remain here to grow and train as you suggested." Raven was unable to mask her surprise.
But then our forces will have no chance against Fata's slave army. Not without the dragons."
Fire sighed in frustration.
"First you don't want to bring the dragons, and now you do. Which is it?" "I don't want you to go to war at all. Not yet." "We are going to war," Fire said. There was no room for argument in her tone. "It's just a matter of where and when."
"Still, if you mean to cross the Burning Sea and march on Fenia, it will take time. Months. Maybe years."
"What if we don't cross the Burning Sea?" Fire asked.
"What?"
Raven said. Goggin patted his barrel-shaped chest, frowning.
"Are you proposing we cross the Skara? The desert would take much out of our forces even before we forded the spear. And then we would be forced to fight the Southron border cities. Susa, Hemptown, Gem City. Before entering the death trap of the Bloody Canyon. Even if we made it to Fenia, we would face an army of tens of thousands of slaves forced to fight and die for Emperor Hosa."
"At least the Guanero leader is finally making sense," Raven thought.
"I agree," she said. "The Skara is out of the question."
"Nothing is out of the question,"
Fire shot back.
"And I wasn't proposing we take that route. Just the Skara."
Raven pursed her lips before asking,
"So we cross the Skara, and then what? Raft down the spear into the Burning Sea?"
"No, sister. We march northwest."
"Northwest?"
Raven was so confused she could barely decipher the meaning of the word.
"But the only thing northwest is..."
She raised her eyebrows, finally understanding what her sister was proposing. Perhaps what she'd been planning all along, since the moment she found their martyr's plague-covered body. Fire grinned.
"Aha! So now you see. We shall attack the Southron gates from the southern side."
"To what purpose?"
Goggin asked. This time it was Raven who supplied the answer.
to weaken the Phoenician defences against the Western Kingdom.
Goggin scratched his head.
The West hasn't attacked the South in many decades. Why would they now?
Raven still remembered the stream they'd received from their spies in the West days earlier, when her mother was still Empress, when son Sans was still alive. Rhea Loren has seized power in the West. It is said she cares more for dancing than ruling, and Lord Griswold has declared himself King of the North, and is amassing forces at Blackstone. He will take the West, and then he will march south toward the Southron Gates. If the gates are destroyed, nothing will be able to stop him.
If we destroy the gates, Fire continued, the North will do battle with the slave army instead of us.
And regardless of who wins, we will be in a strong position to claim whatever is left, Raven said.
She hated to admit it, but her sister's plan was creative and bold. It was the last thing their father would expect them to do.
"Prepare our armies for the desert," Fire said, convening the council.
Part 2. Jai, Rhea, Roan, Anis, Grey, Raven. The curse of war will spread, filling the land with darkness as it must, for without dark there can be no light. The Western Oracle.
17. The Southern Empire fanes. Jai Jaru.
By the time the thousands had entered the tunnel ahead of Jai, the sky was black, almost melting into the black rocks until he couldn't tell one person from the next. Jai paused a moment, staring at the darkness that had just swallowed his entire world.
"Come on,"
a little voice said, and a small hand shot from the dark, grabbing his and pulling him forward. Jig had insisted on waiting with him until the end, but now the boy was anxious to press forward. Holding the boy's hand tightly, he slid his fingers along the rope. Voices echoed through the tunnel, seeming to take shape in the dark, bouncing off the walls and tumbling around his feet. Jig said,
"Will the West be on the other side?"
Jai could almost believe it would be, though he knew the Southron Gates were still a great distance away, to the north, somewhere beyond the Bloody Canyons and the four border towns.
"No, but we will be safe for a time."
"How long will Emperor Hoza search for us?"
There was such childlike innocence in the boy's question that Jai knew his heart would break if he told the truth.
"Forever."
So he changed the subject.
"Can you see anything?"
"Not even the person in front of me,"
Jig said with a laugh. The boy's laughter buoyed Jai's spirits. Growing up in Garadia, this boy learned to embrace the dark, rather than fear it. They all did. He would be fine. Perhaps they all would be. As they walked, the scenery began to change. The black turned to grey, turned to shadows of bodies, scuffling along single file. Rough rock walls appeared on each side, and ahead of them, the outline of an opening. And then they were free of the rocky throat, spilling out into an enormous area sheathed in green light, only the edges cloaked in shadow. Though the entire area was surrounded by cliffs, there was no roof, the one half-moon and its army of stars staring down, providing more than enough light to see by. The other moon had risen somewhere out of sight. The sound of splashing reached Jai's ears, and he discovered a line of people waiting to take their turn in a large natural pool nestled between several large boulders. Other groups had already formed circles and were fast asleep. Still others were breaking bread and drinking from skins. The scene was so utterly familiar they might have never left Garadia, but there was one stark, crucial difference. Now they were free. Though he was bone-weary, Jai's mind was very much awake, racing with a mixture of fear and excitement for the future. He'd done what he set out to do at long last, and he had formidable allies to help him. Jig, Viola, and their mother were all asleep, their deep inhalations and exhalations falling into cadence with each other, like they were three parts of the same person. Jai stood and slipped away, silently stepping between the hundreds of sleeping bodies sprawled throughout the canyon. He spotted Axa sleeping, gripping his mirror with fisted hands.
There was a circle of space all around him, as if he carried a contagious disease. Perhaps he does, Jai thought. The disease of superiority. Something drew Jai toward the center of the arena, where he craned his head back and looked up at the vast night sky. A dark shape soared overhead, but he couldn't tell whether it was a vulture or some other less dangerous bird. He scanned the cliffs, his gaze settling on a shadow. The shadow moved. Someone was up there. A slash of fear cut through him, but then he breathed. There was no way someone loyal to the Emperor could have followed them this far. It had to be one of their own. The fierce warriors of the Black Tears were sleeping in a group near the water. Sonika's dark hair was spread out around her head like a black veil of mourning. Jai counted their numbers and came up one short. Who? Shanti, he realized. The Terran with an affinity for fire root powder. Jai traced a line from her shadow on the cliff to the ground, planning his climb. Then he started up. There were plenty of hand and footholds, and several ledges where he was able to stop and rest. However, by the time he reached the top, his arms ached, and he was wondering whether he should have just stayed on the ground and tried to sleep. Shanti said, "Look." She didn't turn around, the Terran continuing to gaze across the night-dark terrain, which was spread out like a three-dimensional canvas before them. Jai looked, his chest tightening because of the sheer wonder of the view. The rocks, which were as black as tar in the daylight, were sheathed in dueling moonlit armor, green and crimson forms that were as beautiful as the stars, as if echoes of their light. The stars were like flower buds opening in the sky, red, green, gold. It's... There was only one word for what he was seeking. Perfection. Shanti's head cocked to the side to look at him, a smile playing on her soft-looking pink lips. Yes, she said, like the world we live in. Jai couldn't agree with that. This world is a horrible place. No, she said, shaking her head. The world is perfect. We're the only ones who make it horrible. And yet there is beauty amongst us, too. Surely you can see it in your people. Yes, he could. Despite their scars and disfigurements, both emotional and physical, his people were beautiful. I fear I risk too much by helping them escape. The road ahead will be hard. Freedom is not always easy, but it is always right. But remember, you can't command someone to be free. Jai considered her words, which, he had to admit, stung a little. What was she saying? That he was just another master? No, he thought, inwardly chiding himself for being so sensitive. She was merely saying that they had a long way to go before true freedom was achieved. Jai nodded his agreement. A sudden urge to tell her about his mother, his father, swelled inside him, but he breathed evenly until it melted away. He feared if he spoke of what he'd lost, that he would crumble like brittle stone. All I want is to give them happiness, he said instead. Shanti touched his hand. Her fingertips were warm. You have. I observed them today. They are happy. At least as happy as they can be, given their circumstances. But they're not safe. Not by a long shot. They will be. She patted his hand, and Jai wondered if she was a touchy person by nature, or if the gesture was just for him. He found himself hoping it was the latter. When he didn't respond, she asked, "How did you learn the defense arts?" "My father." The two words slipped out so easily it was like they were resting on the tip of his tongue. Shanti pointed up at the green moon goddess, Luahi, for which Fen Lu had been named. It is said that a true master can summon the power of the night goddess. Yes. He pointed at the red sliver of the moon god that was still visible. And they say masters of Fenru are powered by Ruahi. But I've never seen anyone do either. Me either, Shanti said. A memory rose to the top of Jai's mind. His mother, dancing Fen Sir, while he and his father watched. She was so graceful, beautiful. Like water sliding past smooth stones, like a bird soaring across the sky. "I've seen someone harness Sarai's power while dancing," he blurted out. Shanti raised her coppery eyebrows.
"Really? The sun goddess shined on a dancer? Who?"
"My mother. I didn't know her name. A stranger." The lie was bitter on his tongue, but he couldn't open this door. Not now. She looked away, her large blue eyes floating back toward the rocklands, and he took the opportunity to study her face, which was framed by her short hair. Once more, he counted her tears. Still 17. "When will you add your tears for the battle at Garadia?" he asked. She licked her lips.
"I have no tears to add tonight."
Absently, she withdrew her hand and touched it to her face, tracing her fingers along each black teardrop. "I would have thought a fierce warrior such as yourself would have killed at least one of the Mine Masters." She chuckled.
"I killed 3. But that is not what the tears represent."
Jai couldn't hide his surprise.
"But everyone says everyone is wrong," she said. "That's just the rumour spread by the Emperor to make his citizens fear us. If they represented those we've killed, all of our faces would be entirely covered in darkness."
It took a moment for that information to sink in. She must have killed hundreds, then. They all had.
"Then what are the tears for? Why do some of you have more than others? Why do you have so many?"
"They are reminders," she said. Her hand dropped to her side, closing over a small rock.
"Of what?"
"Of who?" she corrected.
"They are memories of those we've lost. The ones we fight for. The reason we kill."
Jai shivered, but not because of the cool breeze wafting over them. Shanti threw the rock, and they both watched as it rose, arced, and then fell into oblivion. Down below, a scream shattered the silence of night. It took Jai longer than Shanti to descend from the cliffs to the ground, and when he arrived on the scene, all of the black tears were standing in a circle, blocking his view of a figure writhing on the hard rock floor.
"Please,"
he said, and they parted. Sonika's eyes met his, but he couldn't tell what she was thinking. And then he saw who it was. Axa, his face contorted in pain, several parts of his body bleeding, crimson streams running down his arms, his face, his chest. The gemstones that had been sewn into his skin had been ripped out, leaving trails of broken flesh. No one moved to help him.
"Who did this?" Jai asked.
A form stepped forward, his palms open, glittering with rubies and emeralds and diamonds. Blood dripped between his fingers.
"They weren't his,"
Joaquin said, his black eyes unblinking. 18. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. The man walked, using a gnarled tree branch as a cane. Though Rhea suspected it was all part of his act, she detected no limp in his stride. He stood before her, meeting her gaze with steely grey eyes that never seemed to blink.
"Kneel before your queen," Ennis said.
Though her cousin was wholeheartedly against bringing this man here, he was still utterly loyal to her claim on the crown, a fact that continued to delight her. The man said,
"I kneel before none but Roth."
"You will kneel, or you will be made to—"
Ennis snapped. But Rhea silenced him with a hand. She smiled. She liked this man already. His defiance, his fearlessness.
Bold words for an outcast.
They called him the Summoner, which was the same title his father had worn before him, and his father's father. And on for centuries. Somewhere along the lines, one of the Loren monarchs had determined the Furies were the true warriors of Roth, not these shadowy summoner men. However, out of respect for their history, they'd been permitted to live, so long as they didn't speak their sacrilegious words in public.
"In Roth's eye, I am no outcast," the man replied. "Have you brought me here to kill me?"
History had a way of jading people, Rhea mused. What would you do if I had? What would you summon using that legendary power of yours?
The man dropped his cane and stood tall, his hands extending to each side. His mouth opened wide in a silent howl, and his arms shot over his head, palms forward. Ennis moved to grab him, to stop him from doing whatever it was he was doing, but then the man dropped his hands and began laughing. Ennis grabbed his arm and said, "Watch yourself, old fool. Your games are not appreciated." Duly chastened, the man stopped laughing and looked back at Rhea.
"I do not summon. Roth summons. I am but his mouthpiece, his hands and his feet in the second heaven."
Rhea nodded.
"I heard a story when I was a child," she said. "A story about a great monster that lived in the sea."
"Brathos," the man murmured, speaking the name reverently.
Ennis said,
"That vile creature is now known as Demonos, if it ever existed at all." "It existed," the man hissed. "It exists."
"Good," Rhea said. "And you believe it is still loyal to Roth?"
"Yes, for God created it, just like me."
"And you can, as Roth's mouthpiece, summon it again?"
"Princess, I mean queen, no," Ennis said.
"That thing is not of Roth. It is a demon, the spawn of the devil himself. You cannot control it." "I can, and I will," Rhea said.
She turned to the Fury, who had watched the entire exchange with mild interest.
"Show the summoner to one of the empty suites. Give him all that he desires."
"I desire nothing but your trust, Your Highness," the summoner said.
He bent down and retrieved his stick, breaking it in half over his knee.
"I already have everything else."
"Rhea!"
her twin brother and sister cried in unison. They rushed to the bars and pushed their hands between them, reaching for her. She took a step back. They were filthy from sleeping on the dirty floor. They were thinner, too, which made them look even more like the weasels that they were.
"Rhea?"
Leo said again, his eyebrows pushing together. His long blonde hair was greasy and stringy, making him appear as ordinary as a street rat.
"Get us out of here! They said Cousin Jove was dead. He was supposed to be the king."
"Yes,"
B agreed, nodding rapidly.
"They said we had to hide down here for our own safety. But we're safe now, aren't we?"
Even in such a disheveled, malnourished state, she was utterly breathtaking, her blue eyes like turquoise crystals, her golden locks lustrous, curling around her chin. Rhea hated her perfect, porcelain features. She longed to cut off her curls, to draw lines down her face, to mar her perfection. The twins looked pathetic in the dungeons. Once, Rhea might have felt sorry for them, might have offered them a second chance, been merciful. But not any more. The memory of how they'd scorned her, mocked her, pointed accusing fingers at her, was seared in her mind. They knew the truth about the W scarred into her face, what it really represented. And they had big mouths. No, there would be no redemption for the snivelling brats that stood before her, pleading. She said nothing, turning her back on them as they cried for her to return and set them free. Ennis walked beside her, prattling in her ear. He spouted his usual objections and religious quotes, and mentions of Rhea's best interests and the peace and safety of the kingdom. Rhea ignored him and focused on the citizens of Night's End, who stopped what they were doing to watch her march through the city, surrounded by Furia. She noticed several with the familiar W slashed across the whole of their faces. They were on their knees, their hands clasped together, their lips parted as they whispered silent prayers to Roth. Rhea kissed her fingers and extended them in their direction. The devoted, as they were now being casually referred to, instantly collapsed, as if touched by the hand of Roth. Rhea wasn't certain whether her newfound power was actually bestowed by Roth, or whether she'd simply planted that in the people's minds. But it didn't matter. All that mattered was she had it,
and she would use it to make the West great again. She caught a few darker, less friendly stares, too. These were the unbelievers, either in Roth or in her. She knew, with an uttered word and a flick of her fingers, her fury would punish them, even kill them, if she wanted. But she stayed silent, offering them each a smile and a nod, to which they responded with surprised looks. She knew she would win them over in the end. But if they crossed her... As she continued her march through the city, more and more flocked to her, surrounding her furia, joining the parade. Children called her name and threw wreaths of flowers. Ennis tried to keep the projectiles away from her, but she caught several and draped them over her head and around her shoulders. The children cheered. "Today I visit the Furium," she said to the onlookers. "In the attack on the castle that killed my father, the Furia's numbers were greatly depleted." It was not true, but they didn't know that. Some of them may have seen the three riding south with a large contingent of their righteous sisters, but they did not know that most of the Red Warriors had yet to return. "The Furium is the most important building in our great city, as it is our future. I implore all the young, strong women of Night's End to accept the honour given to you by Roth, and join the Red Ranks, and earn your place in the seventh heaven." Though the throng was now hundreds deep, blocking the streets and disrupting the merchants' daily trade, she could hear her message being passed backwards through the crowd, like a ripple in a pond. Girls of all ages ran ahead of her, laughing and chasing each other as they made their way to the Furium. In some cases, Rhea spied mothers or fathers carrying their daughters, who were kicking and screaming and fighting at every step of the way. Rhea knew it didn't matter. Once inside the Furium, they would be subdued. Broken, if necessary. Recreated in the name of Roth. Forged anew with strength and loyalty. Damaged swords made stronger. In other cases, however, their mothers and fathers tried to grab their children to stop them, pleading with them not to go. But the young girls were swift of foot and nimble, and they soon vanished into the human tide. Their parents dropped to their knees and wept openly. "Halt!" Rhea commanded. Her furia stopped in an instant, taking no more than an additional half-step. Their unquestioning obedience gave her chills. She moved through her lines of red-cloaked women, and they parted like stalks of wheat before a farmer's scythe. When she reached the wailing mothers and fathers, she knelt beside them and touched their cheeks. They looked up with wet, weary eyes. "Cry no more," she said, "for your sacrifice has earned you a place in the seventh heaven." And then she stood and turned her back, continuing on while they praised Roth's grace in her wake. "You should not promise so much," Ennis hissed at her when she returned to her place by his side. She laughed gaily. "Shouldn't I? My promises shall stir them to carry out my will. And when your promises are broken?" She frowned at him, not appreciating his tone. "How can you be certain they will be broken? In any case, I will not be there when Roth refuses them entrance to the heavenly garden of light. You give them false hope. Hope is our greatest weapon," she snapped back. "Hope will build my army and lead us to victory. And if hope doesn't work, there is always fear." Ennis shook his head, but didn't respond. She wondered how long his loyalty would hold, and when the dam broke, whether he would fade quietly into the night or have to be put down. She hoped the former, for she still loved him in a shared history kind of way. They reached the Furium. If not for its bright red arching doors, the nondescript building wouldn't have stood out against the neighbouring structures. A line of red-clad women guarded the entrance, their blades held in both hands, their points touched to the tips of their noses. Actually, calling them women was being generous, for none of them appeared older than Rhea, who was naught but 16. And yet they were disciplined, their eyes never shifting from their steadfast gaze forward, even when Rhea walked slowly past them, waving her hand across their faces. The Fury stood silently, watching. Rhea turned to her. "These are your best?" she asked.
"We have no best. We are all equal.
Even you?" Yes. There was no hesitation, no lie. This woman believed her words from the depths of her soul.
And if you die?
I shall be replaced by another. Rhea nodded.
Good.
She gazed behind the guards. A crowd of girls were being funneled inside, the new blood Rhea had recruited as she marched through the city.
May I go inside?
In truth, it wasn't a request, but a command. But Rhea was in public, and she needed to keep the appearance that the Furia was separate from the monarchy, an independent, law-keeping body.
Of course,
the Fury said. Without being asked, two of the guards stepped aside. Momentarily, the line of recruits was halted so that Rhea could enter the structure. Inside was a red-painted atrium with unadorned walls, save for a large image of Roth. As taught by the Furia, God appeared as neither man or woman, human or other creature. The form had the face of a human, the arms of a tree, dark clouds bursting with lightning atop the head, pointed blades for teeth, swirling tornadoes for legs, the eyes of a tiger and the nose of an elephant. God was everything in creation, constantly changing. Rhea noticed something else. Many of the features were constructed of gemstones, glittering on the wall. Despite the Furium's modest appearance, there was great wealth here.
There's wealth in serving Roth,
Rhea mused appreciatively.
Wealth and power. A lethal combination. Carry on,
she said, watching with interest as the new blood continued to move through the line. First, they were stripped naked, every possession they carried or wore taken from them. Some girls protested, but most didn't. Some covered themselves with their hands, but most didn't. The Fury spoke to them.
We are all naked in the sight of Roth. We have nothing to hide, nothing to be ashamed of.
From this moment forward, you are not beautiful or ugly, not strong or weak, not large or small. Here you simply are. Here we are all sisters. Here we are all kin. Together we will fight and die if necessary, for Roth's will. Next, a pail of water was dumped on the head of each girl. Several of the Furia would then descend on them, scrubbing their skin so hard it turned red. The Fury continued her monologue.
The outside world has made you filthy, even the most righteous of you. We cannot allow the worldly filth to enter this sacred place. You are not clean until it hurts.
Some of the girls began to cry out from the pain, while others bore it with gritted teeth of determination. Once each girl was deemed to be sufficiently clean, she was taken to an area with a large vat filled with a red liquid resembling blood.
Is that?
Rhea said.
Dye,
the Fury said.
Of course.
Each girl's hair was then dyed red, including their eyebrows. Finally, they were dried off and given the familiar acolyte's robe, which was half red, half white. Rhea walked along a line of fresh acolytes, who were being taught to stand at attention, though most of them flicked their eyes to look at her when she passed. It was strange how similar they were already beginning to look after only a few changes. The red hair, the robes, the scrubbed skin.
They really could be sisters,
Rhea thought.
I want to see more, she said.
The Fury hesitated for the first time since Rhea had broken her into a million pieces. Immediately she understood why. The Fury had just explained how nothing touched by the outside world could enter the Furium. She could see the young girls looking at their leader, wondering what she would do. The moment felt important. A hinge that would either open a door or close one forever. Rhea offered her an out.
Of course, I will succumb to the standard process of any acolyte, she said. I am not above Roth's law.
She knew she'd spoken wisely when she saw relief flood the Fury's eyes. She said,
You have already taken the mantle of Roth when you cut your face, like me, which keeps you clean from this world. Follow me.
She turned on her heel and entered the next room. Rhea followed shortly after, and she could hear the sounds of a new group of girls being brought in for cleaning, dyeing, and robing. The area beyond the atrium was an enormous training yard. Full-fledged Furia taught acolytes of various skill levels the art of killing. By sword, by poison, by hand-to-hand combat. They were learning it all. In one corner, a large group were praying together, their voices chanting as one. Rhea saw two girls who couldn't be more than 5 name days old, doing battle with wooden poles. One of the girls dodged the other's attack and then smashed the butt of her stick into the girl's face. The young girl fell back, clutching her nose as blood ran between her fingertips. Tears sprung from her eyes, pouring down her cheeks. The victor bent down to apologize, to help her up. The Fury said, "Stop!" The girl froze, her eyes wide with fear.
"I hurt her," she said.
"And she will hurt you one day. Would you have her shame you by showing weakness? Would you have her treat you like a suckling babe, and not one of Roth's warriors?"
"No,"
the girl said. "Correct. Now leave her. She can pick up her own pieces. She will return stronger the next time." Already the injured girl's tears had dried up. She wiped the blood away on the red half of her cloak. Then she stood, a look of determination crossing her face. She grabbed her pole. The two girls fought again, and this time the girl with the bloody nose got the better of her opponent, tripping her and throwing her down. Rhea was transfixed as she watched the process repeat over and over again, with the girls alternating victories. There were no more tears, though there was more blood drawn. "You have done well with this place," Rhea said. The Fury bowed slightly, but said nothing. "Tell me, where did the other two go? The other members of the three? They took a girl with them. She was sin-marked. They stole half of the Furia." Rhea remembered Grey's strength as he searched for his sister Shay, his determination. He looked as though he would go to the ends of the world to find her. At first she'd hated him for leaving her to the mercy of the Furia, but now she silently thanked him. He'd set her free, allowing her to become what she'd become. "Yes," the Fury said. "They wanted to understand the girl." Rhea frowned. "Understand? Study. Observe. Discern what power her mark bestowed upon her. They didn't already know?" She shook her head. "And neither, it seems, did the girl. Or so she claimed. Her mark is a mystery." Rhea noticed that she didn't call it a sin mark. Just a mark. It was highly unusual for a woman of Roth. "Yes, but it shouldn't matter. If she is marked with sin, then she must be killed. Correct? That is what has been taught for decades." "Yes, it has," the Fury said, but it wasn't an answer. "Then why isn't Shay Aris dead?" "It's complicated." "Tell me," Rhea growled. She grabbed the woman by the front of her robe. The Fury flinched. There it was, that fear. Though this woman was a trained warrior and could kill Rhea in any number of ways, she feared her now, like a dog beaten to within an inch of its life by its master. "What do you know of the Western Oracle?" the Fury asked. Rhea released her, letting out a breath. "Children told stories about her. She was a witch, a sorceress, lover of demons and darkness, an outcast. She was burned at the stake." The Fury shook her head. "No, she was none of those things, save for an outcast and burned at the stake. The rest was a lie told by your great-great-great-grandfather. She was no witch. She was once one of the three. She was the very first Fury."
19. The Western Kingdom, The Tangle. Rhone Loren.
"I think the sun rose from that direction," Gareth said, pointing toward a part of the forest that was so dense they couldn't see past the line of gnarled bushes. Then again, every part of the tangle seemed to be getting thicker, fighting them every step of the way. Gwendolyn squinted. "I'm certain it rose from there," she said, gesturing the opposite direction. Rone grimaced, plucking a thorn from his skin. Blood welled up from a pin-sized hole. Dozens of similar holes dotted his arms.
"We need to climb a tree. It's the only way."
"You're not scared of the ore monkeys?" Gareth said, an amused look on his face.
"You think this is funny?" Rone said. "We could starve to death in this forsaken place."
"My apologies, Your Highness," Gareth said, smirking.
"It was merely a quip, which was obviously in bad taste." "I wasn't aware of the thorns stuck up your—"
"Shut it, you fools," Gwen said.
"I thought I heard something."
"Like Gareth's sense of humour shriveling up and dying," Rone said. "And don't call me Your Highness."
"Am I mistaken? Are you not the heir to the Western Throne?"
"No more than you're the heir to the Eastern Crown, Your Highness."
"I'm supposed to be dead. I saved your life."
"I didn't ask you to."
Gwen punched Gareth, hard. He cringed, massaging his shoulder. Rone started to laugh, but then she punched him, too, even harder, or at least so he suspected. He was about to protest, but then he heard it, too. A sound, carrying over the rustling leaves and creaking branches. Someone was singing.
"What the bloody hell is that?" Gareth said.
"Someone singing," Rone said. Gareth glared at him.
"You ask a dumb question. If you two don't cease your infernal bickering, I will seal your lips with ore the next time we're in Ironwood."
Rone was fairly certain he would never return to the ore forest, but he didn't want to risk it.
"Where is it coming from?"
The sound rose up again, louder this time. It was melodious, beautiful, full of hope and life and love, but mournful too, a sadness so deep it seemed to settle into Rone's skin and bones. Gwen and Gareth, once more, pointed in opposite directions. Rone didn't agree with either of them. He thought the voice was coming from out of the ground, or perhaps from somewhere high above, almost like the sound was all around them. No, in them.
"Why would someone be singing in the middle of the tangle?" Gareth asked.
"I don't know, but I think we should find out who it is," Rone said. As soon as he said it, the idea seemed to take root in his mind, and he could think of nothing else.
"This way. We're close."
He dove into the brush, oblivious to the spiky branches and thorns that slashed his skin. He heard Gareth say something behind him, about exploring in a different direction, and Gwen shouted for both of them to stop. But her command bounced off of Rone's ears, which could only listen to the words of the song, which seemed to flood through his soul. "Once there was a maiden in Tanglewood's keep, resting her head on moss and fern leaf, wishing for one to sweep her away, break her chains, and lead her astray. Where are the valiant? Where are the brave? The handsome king with a maiden to save? If he passes the test, he can have her love, tender as a lamb and pure as a dove." As the song ended, Rone felt as if a piece of him had been hacked off and stripped away, leaving him empty inside. He redoubled his pace, plunging ahead through branch and leaf, thorn and vine, slapping the barriers away, bouncing off of spiky trees until the ground seemed to sink away from his feet, leaving him hanging in midair, tangled in something that gripped his arms and legs. He fought it, not because he was scared, but because he needed to continue toward whomever was singing, needed it like he needed blood in his veins, air in his lungs, water in his throat. The voice came back to him, closer now, tantalizingly close.
"Welcome, handsome king. You are just in time."
The voice was as clear as a burbling spring, as strong as a lion's roar, as melodious as birdsong. Somewhere in his mind, Rone was aware that the voice was not spoken out loud, but in his head, sliding through his skull. He peered through the gaps in the net, for that's what he was caught in, not of rope, but of vine, as if the trees themselves had conspired against him. But he didn't care, not one whit, because the bearer of the song, of the voice, appeared beneath him. Her gown was a thousand flowers of many colours, golden threads binding them, like rays of sunlight captured and stitched together. Her face was the green of leaf, her hair a blanket of moss, crowned with a nest of thorns. In the hollow of her throat hung several silver lockets, dangling from a necklace constructed of seeds strung together.
"How can I help you?"
Roan asked, despite the fact that it was he who was a captive. He stopped trying to fight through the net, which was no longer of consequence to him, not while this angel of the wood stood beneath him, not while she spoke his name with such reverence.
Roan Loren. Distantly, he wondered how she knew who he was,
but the concern flitted away on the gentle breeze. Something crashed through the forest, bursting into the clearing, broken branches and tattered leaves clinging to shirt and trousers. Gareth.
"What is that fool doing here?" Roan thought.
"Leave us," he said.
"I am helping her."
Gareth snarled at him.
"I am helping her."
The woman laughed, and the sound was like approaching rainfall. Roan felt himself melt into a puddle.
"You can both help me. You are both the handsome, brave kings in my song."
A muffled voice cried from elsewhere in the wood.
"Roan! Gareth! You fools! Where are you?"
The voice was familiar to Roan, but sounded rougher, like bark scraping against his ears. He didn't want her to find them. What was her name again? He couldn't remember, but that didn't matter. He wanted only to be here, to be close to the woman of the forest, to be her hero, her handsome, brave king. The net that held him drifted to the ground and slowly released him. Gareth strode up to him, drawing his sword.
"Back off," he growled.
Though Roan had abhorred violence his entire life, he wanted to dismantle the prince piece by piece. He had no weapons, so his fists would have to do. He swung at Gareth, who ducked, slashing his blade across Roan's midsection. The edge caught a loose bit of clothing, which fluttered to the ground like a wounded bird. Roan aimed another punch.
"Stop!"
Gwendolyn commanded, grabbing his arm from behind, holding him back. She twisted Roan's arm behind his back, but he barely felt the bite of pain, because he needed to get to the green-faced woman, needed to be her brave king, needed to— Gwendolyn swung around him and blocked a blow from Gareth's sword with her iron bow, which she then fitted with an arrow, firing swiftly at the woman.
"No!"
Roan screamed in his head. But the woman had already lifted a shield of thick bark, blocking the arrow, which embedded itself harmlessly in the wood. She extended her hand, and vines shot from her fingertips, grabbing Gwen's bow and wrenching it out of her grasp. Gwen tried to flee, but the vines had already wrapped around her arms and legs too, tightening, circling around her body like cloth around a mummy, until only her face was visible. In the confusion, Roan saw an opportunity, rushing at Gareth and tackling him to the ground. Gareth lost his sword, but managed to roll, pinning Roan beneath him.
"I don't want to kill you, but I will if I have to." "Not if I kill you first,"
Roan declared, kicking hard, bucking Gareth to the side. He snatched the sword from the ground, lifted it, and brought it down toward the prince's face.
"Stop!"
Though the word was naught but a whisper, Roan felt its power in the very marrow of his bones. His arm froze, the sword's edge close enough to shave the stubble from Gareth's cheeks. Gwendolyn muttered something about how they didn't listen to her when she told them to stop. Apparently she could hear the woman's voice in her head, too. A thought that made Roan insanely jealous.
"My heroes, my brave kings, I think I will keep you both."
"What do you mean, keep them?" Gwen said. And then,
"Oh, Orr, you're a wood nymph, aren't you?" "Shut your mouth, Orion."
Though it was clear to Roan that the words were spoken in anger, they were as soothing as gentle waves lapping against a sandy shore.
"This does not concern you." "These are my friends, nymph, so I, it concerns me. And yet you have no power here. This is my domain. I have no use for you. However, because I am merciful, I will permit you to return home to Ironwood. Now go, or I'll be forced to kill you."
The vines slithered away from Gwendolyn's body, returning into the woman's fingertips. Roan was captivated. Gwen, however, didn't move.
"Roan,
Gareth, this woman is a liar and a witch. She has cast a spell on you with her song. Fight it. She can't take you if you don't want her to. But Roan did want her to take him. It's all he wanted. Go, he said.